Shares. Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is coming to you on the weekend with a special bonus mailbag edition. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, and especially on this Sunday, Dr. Anirban Mahanty. How are you, Doc?
I'm good.
How good is this mailbag episode?
I love mailbag.
I'm sorry, I did spring this on you without notice.
But I had no idea that we were doing this, so.
We were recording live, and I just thought, we're not getting through the questions. We're running out of time. The podcast can only really be so long before we drive people nuts, so. But I didn't want to leave the other questions that people have. We've got such great questions this week. We got a lot of them.
My excuse is going to be that I have not read the questions. I don't know what the questions are. So if my answers are silly, it's all your fault.
That's always the fun, mate. That's the fun.
But I got to blame someone.
Mate, you always got to blame me. That's all right. That's what I'm here for. Should we get straight into it?
Yeah, let's do
Beautiful.
It.
Mate, we got a great question from Mitch. Mitch came through on Facebook, which is awesome. I will do a quick social shout out because we're doing a special mailbag edition. If you want to get in touch with us, if you're on Facebook, and who wouldn't be other than Doc, who's irrationally hateful of the company?
Why would you be on Facebook?
You can get us on Facebook now. We're at The Motley Fool Australia, I think it is on Facebook. Or I'm at Scott Phillips Money is my personal page. I love you all, but I'm not going to add you. I do on my personal page, but I have a business page. So you can, at Scott Phillips Money is where I am on Facebook. You can hit us up on Twitter, which is kind of probably the best way to do it because we get to all interact in public, which is kind of nice there. We are at The Motley Fool AU. I'm at TMF Scott P. And Doc is at Anirban Mahanty. Or you can hit us up on Instagram if you've got some, you know, photos of sunsets or food or... Don't do that. Just don't do the sunsets or food. Really, seriously.
Just put photos of your dogs.
Anyway.
Dogs are fine.
If you're on Instagram, because all the cool kids are these days, and so we thought we should be, not because we're cool kids, but because we know the cool kids are. And hey, who doesn't want to look good by association? So you can get us there at The Motley Fool AU, or again, I'm at TMF Scott P. So hit us up with questions, comments, feedback, suggestions, particularly if you've got nice things to say. If you don't, then, you know, keep them yourself. Mitch heads up on Facebook, mate, and said, "Hi, Scott and Doc. I'm a huge fan of the podcast. You guys are legends." That must be your brother Mitch, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. He said, "I'm a fairly young investor in my mid-20s. Bastard. And the podcast has really helped my understanding. The question I have for you is around valuing a company. I was interested in what Doc was saying about PEG ratios. I've done some PEG ratios on some companies I'm interested in, like Treasury Wine Estates, and I'm getting a PEG over 1.5. Would this be an indication that the share may be overvalued? What are some other factors that I might have missed that I should consider? Keep up the great work, guys, and fool on." Mitch, that is awesome. Doc, I'm going to start, as I tend to, by asking you to define our terms. What the hell is the PEG ratio?
So first of all, I'll say that I don't remember actually talking about the PEG ratio, but I'll take a stab at defining at least PEG. So PEG stands for, the PE of the PEG stands for price to earnings.
Right, and people should know the price earnings ratio by now. What's the price earnings ratio?
So that's just the share price divided by earnings per share.
So if my share price is $100 for the Motley Fool podcast company, and we earn $10 in earnings in a given year in profit, let's call it profit, that's what we call it here.
Where is that $10 coming from?
But you know, it's all the advertising and all the stuff. So $100 share price divided by $10 of earnings is a PE of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And normally, all things being equal, lower is better than a higher. If I could buy a share for a cheaper PE rather than a higher PE, then I'm getting more earnings for my dollar. Now, that doesn't mean high PE companies are bad, but if you're given the choice, you buy any company cheaper. So a cheaper PE is, generally speaking, better than a higher PE, but not necessarily the only companies you should buy. But in any case, that's it's one version of valuation. So then that's the PE of the PEG. What's the G?
Yeah, so G is the growth rate. And I guess it's the growth rate of earnings, right? So if earnings are growing at, make up your example,
20%,
then that gives us what in this particular case?
So 10 divided 10, by 20?
10 divided by 20 is 0.5.
Right.
So now you can now start.
In this case, the lower, the better.
Is better. Yeah. It basically means that you are paying less for the underlying growth. So the idea here behind PEG, PEG is a very simple metric. What the idea behind PEG basically is that if there are two companies with PE of 10.
Oh, this is, cool.
Right? Yep. The two companies with PE of 10, they are not necessarily the same, because what you want to really look at is you want to look at which one is growing at what rate, right? So the one growing at 20% versus the one growing at 10%.
Okay.
Ideally, if they are both at PE of 10, and there's no other factor involved, and
All else being equal, as the economists say, yes.
All else being equal, the futures are equally bright.
Yes.
Then the one on PE of 10 with growth rate of 20%, which is on a peg of 0.5, is better.
Right. So that makes sense, right? If you get a chance to buy two companies that are in theory valued on current earnings at the same as a PE, so both $100, both $10 of earnings, they're both PE of 10. So yeah, they're the same company in theory. But if you knew that in the past or ideally in the future, the Motley Fool podcast company was going to grow at 20%, but the other dodgy finance podcast company was going to go at 10%, well, for the same price, you'd want to buy the company with the higher growth.
Yeah.
And that's where the peg is useful.
Yeah, peg is useful. No, the peg is useful in that context. But the problem with the peg is that because it's a simple measure and everybody knows the growth rate of the previous year, everybody knows the current PE.
Yes.
Everybody can compute this. And in that sense, it starts to fall apart because largely the issue is not, if a company has bright growth prospects, then its shares will appropriately get kind of bid up, right?
So in theory, that should already be priced into the stock.
That should already be priced. I mean, it's very rarely that, if there's a rare company that, is under the radar completely. Like if it's a small micro cap, for example, with low liquidity that not enough people are following, then maybe... For those sort of situations, maybe the peg can come in handy. It's peg.
Or in some questions, you may just have market irrationality, right? Like I think, to be fair, not every large company is equally evenly valued. We've all, for large and small companies, the Motley Fool, done reasonable or very well. I think we're beating the market with almost all of our services by finding companies the market is mispricing.
Yeah.
And peg can be one way of identifying them. But to your point, to some degree, the more widely accepted a metric, and particularly using historical information.
Yeah.
The harder it is to find really good opportunities.
Yeah, especially because you can run a screen, right? So most, you can do a peg screen on pretty much any broker, right? So if you can run a screen, then everybody can run a screen. So, I think you could take the peg forward slightly by thinking about, I think you can think about the current. So for example, a lot of companies that I look at don't even have the E, so the PE is immaterial. So you are now thinking of what the E is going to be in the future. Right, but let's say the company has an E, and therefore you have a PE, price to earnings ratio. Mm-hmm. I think the way to think about that is, you might be paying a price to earnings ratio of, say, 30. That might seem like that's almost double the typical average of the market's PE. The market PE on average is 15, 16, 17. You're paying 30, even 32. So let's say you're paying double.
And someone would say to you, mate, why would you pay 32 times earnings if you buy another company for 16 times earnings.
Exactly. But then what you do is you look at, maybe you look at the past and you look at the future opportunity and maybe you look at treasury and say, well, but if today's earnings is $1 and I can see that earnings grow by 30%, if something is growing by 30%, then they typically are going to, on average, that earnings is going to in 2.5 years is going to double.
Mm.
So effectively 2 years out, the PE is actually 15.
Mm-hmm.
And if that rate even slows down at that point, and then it's just 20 or even 25, it's in the next 5 years, it's going to again double. Mm-hmm. So in 7 years from now, you're going to have a $4 of earnings, in normalized terms I'm talking about.
Yes.
So now the PE has actually gone from 15 to 7.5.
Right.
Right? So...
Which is kind of what the peg some degree tries to capture, right? It's the rate at which the company grows, which makes your investment at... Well, otherwise it'd be 30 times earnings. Or even think about I'll use Amazon and we both own shares. But, at some point at $100 a share 25 years ago, Amazon looked expensive.
Yeah.
At $1,000 a share, it looked expensive. At $2,000, it looks expensive. If and when it delivers enough profit, and it may or may not, we don't know the future, then all of a sudden those share prices that looked historically, $100 for Amazon now looks super cheap, right? When the shares are $2,000 at the time with no earnings, everyone's like, oh, it's ridiculously overpriced. How can you possibly pay $100 for a company with no earnings? The answer was, well, because it's big, it's growing, it's going to become more dominant.
Yeah.
It's the study, or not the study, it's the assessment of the future that matters in investing. As Warren Buffett said, if history was all that counts, the richest people would be librarians.
So I guess I'm being in a circuitous way what I'm trying to say is a peg is useful in the sense that instead of just thinking of the G there as the previous year's growth rate, what I actually like to think about is what's the kind of the growth rate that you're seeing over, say, 5 year period.
Love that.
Annualized.
Yep.
And then if you use that gives you a better handle. Now, of course, you're estimating everything. There's no guarantees of it being correct. You have to, make reasonable judgments. But if you're looking at companies, a bunch of companies, and then you can normalize in this sense, then you get a sense, okay, if I have to choose one over the other, this one is better because of these reasons. And of course, you look at all the other qualitative factors in addition to the quantitative factors.
Yeah.
And the qualitative factors should guide your quantitative
Future expectations.
Yeah, future expectations as well.
Yeah, I'm going to add very quickly, mate, because you've done a wonderful job. To me, PEG does a really nice job of capturing essentially the three things that matter most in investing, right? The price, the company's profits, and how fast it's going to grow in the future. And if you think about those three now, not today's profits, not, I mean, you have to be today's price, right? But the future growth, the future earnings, think about the business model of a company. They're the things you should be paying up for, right? How much money am I going to get? And how quickly is that money going to grow? Now, you have to start in some cases with when is that money going to start turning up, by the way. So if you're not making money now, as Doc said, you want to look to the future and say, when am I going to start making cash and what's that worth? But the framework is a really nice way to encapsulate a good start to think about a business and the sort of things that are going to deliver it profit and the sort of things that are going to help that profit grow over time. Look, Treasury is not one that you cover, Doc. I like Treasury. I own Treasury, for full disclosure. It's also a recommendation of ours as a share advisor, so I do it in my cooking. I think Treasury will have as high risk investor as you. I don't necessarily look for the same size companies or same types of companies. But if I think about Treasury looking forward, I think a truckload more people, in particular in Asia in general and China in particular, we're drinking a heap more Treasury wines. And if I'm right about that, and Treasury can keep increasing prices and volumes, Treasury I think is a very good investment for the long term. I'm talking like a decade plus, right? So I have no idea what happens this year, next year, or the year after. But based on, as you said, the fundamentals and the sort of future growth expectations, I think Treasury will do very, very nice. So I am a shareholder. It is a recommendation of ours. I didn't know the PEG was over 1.5 as it currently exists. The other thing I would say, by the way, mate, very few companies these days, to your point, so back when I was first following the Motley Fool back in the late 90s, because I'm that old, there were a lot of companies, a decent number of companies with a PEG of less than one. Very, very hard these days to find companies with a PEG of less than one, I would argue. I can't off the top of my head think of even any that are growing earnings at a faster rate than their PE. It's very, very hard to find. And if you do find them, then maybe they're worth it, maybe they're not. But I wouldn't just invest on the basis of the PEG.
Yeah, most companies that have high growth potential basically are investing everything into that growth, right? Yeah.
So there's investors know that, right? So they're but they're also investors bidding up the price to the point where you don't get that sort of number. You very rarely get under one for that reason.
Yeah.
Mate, the next question comes from Stephen Sheldon on Twitter. He says, "Hi guys, love the show," in brackets, of course. I don't know what he means. He says, "Can you tell me what's the best way for an investor to consider the likely impacts of global warming when selecting stocks? I know this is a big macro question, and it is, but it seems pretty important." I think we can agree on that one too, Doc. How should Stephen and his fellow listeners, consider the impacts of global warming when buying stocks?
I'm a bit actually confused in the sense, is this a question about investing in stocks that are green, or is it a question of our investing impacting global warming?
If I was a betting man, I would say Stephen is saying global warming is going to happen or is happening. If I own shares in BHP or Woolworths or Telstra or Elmo Software, how should I factor global warming into my investment thesis for the companies I either own or might buy?
Right. Okay. This is a hard one in the sense that I actually don't personally, at least, invest I should retract that. So I do invest based on themes. Like, for example, if global warming is becoming important, therefore I think sustainable something is important. So therefore, if I want to invest in sustainable, energy, then I might find some investments in that area because I think that's going to have a larger and larger share over time. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's one way to do it. Largely, though, I mean, maybe bottom up is better than thematic, because in thematic, the issue with thematic is one might get too caught up with the thematics and then forget about the individual company, because ultimately more than in investing, I think that the bottom up part of looking at the company, looking at what its prospects are relative to where the share price is today and where the share price therefore can be in the future, I think is what matters more. Sometimes thematics can help. Now, if you think, for example, that if you could predict that artificial intelligence is going to become very important, then you invest in that theme. But then again, there too, how do you find the winners in that particular theme? So it kind of becomes hard. That said, I mean, if global warming is going to become a central theme, then I think you can use that to actually decide what not to invest in. I think that becomes an easier problem. So if you think that a large number of people are, or a large number of governments are going to actually, you know, price, put a tax on, say, coal, then maybe not being in coal stocks could be one way of, you know, playing it, right? So, you know, you decide what not to do rather than decide what to do. And I think sometimes that maybe is easier, you know, exclusion versus inclusion.
Yeah, right. Well, it's Warren Buffett's famous too hard pile, right? He says he's got a very large too hard pile. If he simply looks at something and goes, I don't know. I don't feel like I have an answer here. I don't know the answer. Rather than feeling like as many investors do, particularly professional investors like us, and we don't, but our peers in the industry kind of feel like they have to have an answer for everything, right? If someone calls and says, "Hey, what do you think about company X?" You kind of, you know, it's reputationally difficult to say, "I don't know," right? And at some point, you know, people say, "Well, hang on, what am I paying you for if you don't know stuff?" We are in the very fortunate position of having a business that is basically built around our best ideas, not a view on everything. And so we have opinions on stuff from time to time. Do we have an investable opinion on something with enough certainty to say to our members, you should follow this view? Often not. So as you say, sometimes too hard pile is a great way to go. Any more thoughts on global warming investing, mate?
No, global warming is important, but other than that, I don't know
yeah.
much.
Yeah, look, I'll give you a couple of thoughts, Stephen. I will heartily endorse Dr. Deere of just simply avoiding stuff you don't know about. I think that's a perfectly great way to do it. What I would be a little bit mindful of is also taking an opportunity for contrarian thinking when it comes to this. So, for example, I mean, I've ranted about ethical investing. I wouldn't do that necessarily, at least not the way that many people practice it, because I don't think there's value there. That being said, though, one of the things to think about, for example, people say, well, insurance companies are going to go broke because, you know, payouts are going to get higher as global warming impacts, climate change impacts, more catastrophes, more tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, whatever, bushfires. That's all true, with the exception of thinking about how those risks are priced. Now, if you said to someone, I've got a 20-year insurance policy, which pays at any point over the next 20 years based on cyclones, hurricanes, bushfires, I'm going to say, well, I'm getting well away from that one. If you're an insurer, though, and you get to reset your premiums every year, as long as the actuaries of the insurance company are actually factoring in the increased risk and charging higher premiums as a result, there is no reason why you shouldn't potentially, I'm not saying you should, no reason why you shouldn't invest in, say, insurers, for example, right? As long as it's like banks with credit risk. It doesn't matter that some people don't pay their loans off. Banks expect that. Credit cards, the same. Payday lenders, the same for what it's worth. 30% of payday lending clients don't pay their debts back. That's not a problem as long as the rest of the business is priced accordingly so that the risks that don't or that do come to pass are more than covered by the risks that don't come to pass. That's why we have pooled insurance. That's the very idea. If I have a prang on the way home and Doc doesn't, then as long as enough people don't have prangs, my costs are covered and the insurance company is more than fine. If they're pricing in those short-term risks appropriately, you don't need to worry about it. So, you know, one, counterintuitively, I don't think you should necessarily avoid insurance. I would be a little bit careful, as Doc says, with natural resource companies, particularly energy. The view by those who know these things is that if and when governments finally get around to taking meaningful action on climate change, and I don't mean that in a political sense, but I expect they will at some point, then a lot of coal companies will effectively have assets that are, in the lingo, stranded assets. In other words, if we stop burning so much coal because it's bad for the environment, if that comes to pass, I think it probably will, again, not as a political view, but simply as a pragmatic one, then if you own a coal mine with a whole lot of coal in the ground, and there's a very good chance you won't ever get it out of the ground, then you want to think very carefully about how much you pay for that company, even if you own the company shares itself, as Doc says. So taxes are one. Literally, is it ever going to be burnt or taken out of the ground and sold? Is a real question. I mean, if it is, and the scientists are right, if every coal mine in operation now takes all the coal out of the ground that it has, then the planet will warm by 5, 6, 7 degrees and we're all toast. So if the science is right and there's no restriction, then we've got bigger issues of whether or not your coal company loses value. So I'll just throw it out there to be a little bit careful. And again, as Doc says, use the too hard pile liberally.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, Liam sent us a question on Facebook as well. He says, "Hey, Scott and Doc, loving the potty. Started listening a couple months back now. I'm 22. Jeez, you young blokes. Stop rubbing your face in it, will you? I mean, Doc's a young bloke, but I'm getting on a bit. Anyway. I'm 22, started full-time work and taken a real shine to investing. Good man, Liam. I have no background in finance or stocks, but I understand the benefits and I'm putting a lot of time into educating myself." Man, he's on fire. "My question is, I'm trying to encourage my mates to get into investing. However, I'm not educated or convincing enough to win the majority of them over. Have you two done a podcast or have a simply explained resource on why the stock market is the best option, especially at a young age? Or would you be willing to make a money hack episode or even a segment in a podcast simply explaining the benefits in layman's terms so I can refer my friends to listen to? Fool on, he says. How good's that?
That is pretty awesome.
I will take that if you're up.
That's a really good idea.
I don't know if we'll do it. We'll have to think about that. So, look, I want to read that out because it was a question that we got. We don't really have an answer for it just now. But we'll do some version of something, Liam. Hold us to it. If we don't do it the next couple of weeks, make sure you remind us. Look, it's hard. You know, we do a podcast for a general audience, and so we want to make sure our commentary is as broad as possible. Part of the problem, honestly, I had a question from another correspondent who was asking me about, you know, whether we had a particular resource for millennials, right? And the problem, unfortunately, is that most of our investing advice isn't age-specific. Like, you know, if you're 25, 35, 45, 55, 65, we don't have a different way for you to invest because we only know one way to invest, right? And so it's kind of, even though your circumstances might be different, we kind of can't, there's no magic bullet say, oh, if you're 25, then you should be either taking a heap more or a heap less risk, or at 65, you should be, you know, don't take our advice, day trade instead. I mean, there is no kind of plan B when it comes to what we think is best for investing. As long as you have 5+ years, all of our investing is designed with that sort of time frame in mind. So there is no specific advice for millennials, but I think we can do hopefully a decent job in trying to show the millennials the value of investing and why it's worth doing. What do you reckon, Doc?
Yeah, no, I think that's all fair point. I'll just say it one thing to Liam, and this maybe you can tell this to your friends. What I tell people is that the stock market is the single best way to participate in the success of human ingenuity, right? So the human race basically makes progress, and the best way you can partake in that progress and the wealth that progress creates is actually via the stock market.
I like that. And I'm going to give my own page a plug because, hey, if we're not giving ourselves a plug, Matt, what are we doing here? Go to Scott Phillips Money on Facebook. So facebook.com/Scott Phillips Money. I only say that because it just so happens, and it wasn't related, but it ends up nicely. I put up a post on the 1st of October, if you're looking for it. It's now the 3rd or 4th as we record this. And I've dropped in there a Vanguard index chart from 2019. So every 30th of June every year, they update their 30-year index chart. And if you want to tell your mates something, tell them this. If they put $1,000 away 30 years ago, they'd now have $14,634. If they put $10,000 away 30 years ago, and admittedly you weren't alive nor were your mates, that would have turned into $146,000. Now, if they can't get excited about turning 10 grand into 146 grand, well, mate, you got bigger issues and you probably should find better mates. But I'm sure your mates are wonderful blokes. So all I would say is, look, that is the value of compounding. Jump on there, show them that chart. The chart is really, really impressive. It shows you the value of, and that's just investing in an ETF, right? If you can actually beat the market, you'll do even better. If you'd have bought a hypothetical ASX 200 ETF 30 years ago and done nothing, literally not added another dollar, which you should, by the way, if you hadn't, 10 grand becomes $146,000. If you can't get excited about that, then I don't know. I think I'll probably give up.
Yeah.
But good, Matt. We will do something on that. But and good on you for getting your mates involved, mate. More importantly, you are going to... Well, the other thing is, mate, maybe to the extent you're happy to share some stuff with your mates, share it with your experience as you go. If they can see you making some cash, that's probably a really nice way. No one likes your mates getting rich when you're not. That actually might be the most effective way to do it, I reckon, Doc.
Yeah, I think so.
All right, next question. We got a question from Matt. Matt says, hi, Scott and Doc. Love the podcast. Listen religiously. You must be Father Doc and I'm Father Scott.
It looks like that.
Thank you for listening, my son. Have we offended anyone? Probably. If you're religious, I apologize.
At the podcast church we are.
The Church of the Holy podcast. Yep. I have a question I've been thinking about for some time, and that's on the impact of compulsory super on the share market. Now, this one came via email, and when Aaron shared this one with us, I frankly was scared to ask the question because Doc has mentioned his thoughts on this, and this might get ugly. He says, Matt says, every month there is new money coming into the investment market on back of compulsory super, a good chunk of which ends up in Aussie equities. Sure, there's money coming out of the market too from those that have retired, but I'm assuming there's more money coming in than going out through reinvesting dividends, a growing population, wages growth, etc. I've read a lot of Australians retiring now are retiring with not enough super, which would limit how much could get taken out. So with all this money going in, just thinking about supply and demand, do you think there is an underlying pressure for share prices generally to get more expensive over time? And if so, how much of an influence is it? I guess the clue might be in long-term historical PEs from before compulsory super, but I don't have access to reliable data. Lastly, if all this money is flying into the market has some bearing on values, what do you think the outlook will be? We have an aging population, and therefore we could expect this dynamic to change over time as the mix moves to more retirees pulling money out of the market. Thanks for any of your thoughts, Matt. Now, Matt sent this email in, Doc, around the same time as you were, well, I don't think rant is a pejorative. I think rant is a compliment because I do it regularly. So I'll compliment you by saying you had a rant about the impact of super. I imagine you have some thoughts on Matt's question.
Yes, I think this is a brilliant question. Actually, this is I love this question, Matt. We were actually talking about this.
We were.
So I actually have very similar thoughts on this. Like, you know, our superannuation sector is about, what, $2.7 trillion, right?
Give or take. Fourth largest retirement pool in the world.
Yeah, now that's a great thing. But then when you look at the ASX is actually, total market capitalization is around $1.7 trillion. Pretty big.
Yes.
Now, if you go down the whole of the rabbit hole of what is investable and what is not investable, mm-hmm. and what is liquid enough, you actually narrow the ASX down quite quickly to maybe the top 300, 400, 500 companies, right? Mm-hmm. That makes the market cap of that part, you know, maybe it's like, it'll come down to maybe something like 1.4, 1.5 billion. Most of the market cap is there anyways, right? Not in the smaller end of the town.
Right.
Now, as more money comes in, I think there is, you know, I have no proof of this, but, you know, this is, again, a theory I've made up. but I think this, somebody could dig into this. I think there's a real effect because many super funds, and, you know, if your money goes into super, your employer puts your money into super, the money goes into, you know, some fund that you're with.
Yep.
The fund basically says, well, you know, pick between aggressive, growth, moderate, or you know, balanced. Just cash, balanced, yep. You know.
And the default is balanced. And around about 40-odd%, I think, of balance goes to Australian equities as a matter of averages.
Exactly. So now I think that's where it gets interesting, that we have all this money that goes in, and let's say 30 or 40%, you know, in some cases, maybe 50% is going into Australian equities. And Australian equities overall are actually pretty, as a piece of the global equities market, is relatively small. It's like 2 or 3%, right? So we have a large pool of money coming via voluntary or compulsory super, mm-hmm. that in a way is chasing the same small pot, right?
And so effectively you're saying Matt's pretty much right when he says, based on the supply and demand, lots of cash, lots of supply in this case, sorry, lots of demand in this case, only a limited amount of supply. Economics tells me that should push prices up.
Yeah, so that's the thing. And I think, you know, part of if I have to use the word flaw, or the issue here might be the design. But design by default, has got a significant chunk of capital flowing into ASX equities, which, you know, when you consider the size of the market, seems a bit disproportionate. And then you and if voluntary super actually, not actually, keep saying voluntary, it's like, you know, compulsory.
Yep.
And if compulsory super actually increases, there was a proposal sometime back of it going up to like 12% and so on.
And it bloody well should, but I won't rant about that now.
I'm not going to rant about stuff. I'm not even going to this the politics of that and so on.
Assuming it does.
And I think compulsory super is in a way a good thing, right? Because it's a way of, you know, creating a safety net around the society, which is actually overall a good thing. I think the super system is actually a good thing. But I think this is a side effect of how the funds are moving in, which is causing asset price in some sense. It's a contributor. I wouldn't say it's the only contributor. The low rates and so on are also contributors to asset price. But this is a definite, in my mind, at least a contributor.
It's the old politician's line of, it puts upward pressure on prices, right?
Yeah, it puts upward pressure. So therefore, I think the bigger risk in my mind is that if at some point people start thinking, well, you know, we should maybe tweak these, you know, from 40%, it should be 20%,
right.
Or, you know, 40% to 30%, that, you know, so again, these things are hard to know. In general, as I like to say, that there are, you know, there are quality companies which would by many measures appear expensive, but they're expensive largely because they're quality companies and there's funds chasing them,
right.
and they're, you know, and it's you know, you can't really apply the problem here would be that, you know, do you say that you're not going to invest in them because they're quality companies and they look expensive, because they might be more expensive in the future. So this is a little bit of a supply demand issue. I think that's definitely at play, which I think a lot of investors, especially if they come from outside, don't see. Now, I think at some point, if the market becomes big enough, liquid enough, and I think there's another effect at play, many of the companies are small, are big, but not big enough, for example, for shorting to be useful, right? Okay. So therefore, there's not going to be any global hedge fund that's going to come and short a, $500 million market cap company or a $2 billion market company because there's not enough money to be made.
Good. I had shorters.
Yeah. So I think all of those combinations, I think, result in this interesting dynamic. And, and as an investor, it's good to know what dynamic is potentially at play. I say potentially because I have no proof that that's the dynamic. But anyways, yeah, I kind of agree with Matt's thoughts.
Yeah, I completely agree in that as well. I think, the upward pressure, it's almost inevitable, right? The rate of addition to our equity markets is simply higher than it would otherwise be by definition, right? If we didn't have compulsory super, it wouldn't happen. Now, some of that would happen because some people would save voluntarily, and that's always good. We're big fans of that. But the extent of that gain, I don't think it's fair. I don't think we should assume or would assume that Australia would save 10% of its salary arbitrarily without super. So that's definitely the case. It also, by the way, has an impact on property. And so we should think about commercial property here. I think it's less impactful than maybe some might. If you think about the average rental yields of property, commercial property we're talking about, so leave house price alone because it's a whole different question. But commercial property, there's no sense that that necessarily has increased meaningfully over time. We know that somewhere around 10 or 20% of super goes to property, almost all that commercial in some form, whether that's retail, commercial, industrial. And there's no sense that that's necessarily pushed that up meaningfully, at least to unrealistic levels. So I don't know that it's as big as it might otherwise be, but it's almost certainly more than would have otherwise been the case without super. I think that's an unquestioned reality. Simply, we know that Australians as a whole wouldn't have put that much money aside. So it must, by definition, push things up. I think that your point, Matt, I've said this to Doc, and Doc, I don't know if you have a view, but I think you're right, Matt, but I also think that's got probably 20 or 30 years to run. As you said, people retiring now haven't had a full career worth of super, so they simply don't have the sorts of amounts that they would have otherwise had. So there's more money going into super than coming out now. That really won't effectively equalize until people who started working in 1993 when super was introduced. So you turned 18 that year, and your first paycheck you got super for, and you got it all through your career. That's the first time that'll be kind of equalized. After that, then you've got the increases Doc's already talking about. There were increases from 3% to 9%, then 9.5%, hopefully 12% over time. So again, that's a second kind of wave, if you like. Think about those kind of waves crashing on the beach. We don't really hit kind of like for like, really, until we max out that contribution percentage. And that probably is still, I don't know, well, it's not going to happen anytime soon. The current government don't seem too keen. Eventually it'll happen, I hope. But it might be 5 or 6, 10 years till we get to 12. And so you think about, again, 40 years worth of that, up from 9, up from 6, up from 3, there's still a decent way to go. So does it make the market more expensive? Yes. Is it likely to, at any point, be a net negative? I think to Doc's point, the only time it will be is if Australian asset managers rebalance the way they invest their portfolio cash. Otherwise, I don't expect it to be a net drag on the market anytime soon.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, let's move on. We've got another question from another Matt. Matt says, "Hi, Scott and Anirban. Thanks for the podcast. I listen weekly." I might have just accidentally hit the down button, lost the entire thing. I'm going to have to scroll up. How's this for this? People wouldn't believe we do this live, would they?
No.
He says, "I listen weekly and you have opened my eyes and ears up to a number of other excellent podcasts from the Motley Fool US. I've been investing for a few..." Thanks, Matt, by the way. "I've been investing for a few years using a number of Fool services and have also started investing directly in US stocks in January of this year. My question relates to tracking dividends from US companies." Are you ready? "In Australia, I get distribution statements emailed to me, and at tax time, I can log into the share registry that manages the companies I own to see exact dividend payment and franking credit details. I don't seem to be receiving dividend statements from my US investments. However, I've definitely received cash dividends from US into my share trading account. Is there a similar setup with US stocks? Should I expect to receive dividend statements? Are there share registries that manage US stocks? What is the easiest way to track down these payment details for my tax return? With Aussie dividend statements, I can usually see the share registry details. How do I find the registry if I don't have a dividend statement for the US? He then says, "I also note there are stocks sold over the counter," in air quotes. So over the counter is a type of trading in the US, like Tencent Holdings and Dassault Systèmes, that have been recommendations of some US Motley Fool services. My broker does not allow these to be purchased. Can you suggest an online broker that does? Thanks for any guidance or suggestions you can provide. Now, Matt, hopefully between you sending this question and hearing this podcast, you've heard our last podcast where we talked a little bit about the way US stocks are held. The simple answer is you won't get a statement from your registry because they don't exist. There is no CHESS in the US, the computerized holding something system that we have in Australia. The brokers hold all that, and your dividend transactions from your brokerage statement are the best way to get those. Most brokers allow you to simply run a tax report or just a state transactions report. It's what I do from the tax year that I'm looking at. You just put two dates in there, send your report of all the transactions over that period of time. There's no franking credits, unfortunately, so you don't have to worry about that. So that's just a very, very simple way I do it. Doc, your thoughts on tracking dividend payments from US companies?
Yeah, I do exactly what you said. So basically, like, I use Charles Schwab. On Charles Schwab, you can basically get a list of transactions based on transaction types, whether they are trades or dividends or interest or fees and whatnot. So you basically just get that, put it into a spreadsheet, then you basically have to convert it to the Australian dollar, which is a bit of work, but it's very easy now. You take any spreadsheet, all of them have historical information about currency, so you can actually convert it on the date of a transaction to the Aussie dollar equivalent. And there are other ways in which you can do it. You can use monthly and so on, as long as you're consistent. I think, you know, again, talk to your accountant is what I would say. That's that. You could use, you use that. I don't use it. Something like ShareSite, for example.
Correct.
And they can track everything for you. And they can produce a report for you. So that's another.
Cost money, not cheap, but to my mind, well and truly worth it.
That's another way of doing it. Those are the two ways. Mm-hmm. And to answer the last part about over-the-counter stocks, so the OTCs, you could buy them pretty much with any U.S. broker. If you have, like, if you're trading U.S. stocks and you're paying like $20 or $50 for trading them, there's no reason to do that. You know, use something like Charles Schwab to, you know, effectively pay now zero. So and then they would allow you to trade the OTCs. The OTCs are actually an interesting class, because for many, some brokers actually do not allow you to trade them. Some brokers actually charge you a lot more to trade them. Unless you're with a US native broker, they're not really treated as equivalent to any other stock. So that's a good point, and I've seen that happen with some other trading platforms.
Extra levels of complexity with each one. If you're happy with NabTrade and you're making really, really, really small numbers of transactions, maybe stay with them. Doc and I would both say probably do yourself a favor, save some cash, go and find a US broker, ideally one that does OTC. And again, just be careful there. You may not even want to do the OTC if it's, again, too high, depending on which broker you choose. You'd never want to have your universe reduced, but you can probably get away nicely without trading OTC if it comes to it.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
I had a question from David Newen, who says, "Hi, Scott. I'm a Motley Fool subscriber across many services. I was an avid listener of your podcast with Doc. I'm currently listening to the Sunday Mailbag edition while going to work." Hopefully it wasn't working on a Sunday. Hopefully he was listening to it the following Monday. "I've had a lingering question I've been meaning to ask. I have a part of my portfolio in ETFs, as I don't have a lot of time to actively invest. However, I've purchased them through Bell Direct, and the fees are killing me. I want to regularly invest and take advantage of dollar cost averaging, good man, but the fees erode my investments. Most of my ETFs are with Vanguard and BlackRock, and direct minimum investments can be in the range of 25 to 50K, which is more than I want to put in one ETF." Now, when he says direct investment, he means you can actually invest off market, sending money to those guys, which is more than I want to invest in one ETF. Hence the reason I go through Bell Direct. Any thoughts on how I can regularly invest into the ETFs, but without paying the exorbitant fees?" Now, I asked him just as by a follow-up. I said, "Look, you know, how are you doing? What are you doing?" He said, "Look, I currently pay $15 per transaction across 8 ETFs. That's $120 in fees. I only invest every couple of months to cut back in fees, but it's still too high. Any thoughts appreciated?" And then I said, "Look, what ETFs are there?" He said, "I probably invest in Vanguard International, Australian Shares, Magellan Global Equities, a whole lot of other bits and pieces." So, Doc, that's a lot to pay. How would you solve the ETF transaction fee brokerage problem?
Oh, I mean, if you're just investing in certain ETFs, like if you talked about this, maybe, you know, so like something like the Combank, the Pocket app, It could be a raise, Comback, Pocket App. They would reduce your cost if you're just investing in ETFs and not investing in direct shares. I think those would be the probably the better platform in terms of getting in with lower dollar investments. At any, you could basically dollar cost average at one time. That's I think number one. The other alternative is to basically bundle money. So basically, instead of going smaller amounts, you try to increase the amount and therefore reduce the impact of fees. Frankly, I mean, at $15, that's pretty competitive in Australia. The other option might be you can look at something like Saxo Bank. They would give you $6.99 I think for Australian trades, including the ETFs. Anything. They have an asset management fee or custodian fee, but they don't charge a custodian fee on ASX stocks.
Right.
So if you're buying,
still a decent asset management fee though, right?
But you're not paying anything if you're buying the stocks of the ASX.
Oh, right. Like you're not even the management fee.
There's no custodian fee. The custodian fee is for non-ASX.
Yeah, but the asset management fee though?
No, there's no. So there's only custodian fee. Custodian fee is off the total assets. But which is 0.12%, which is pretty, which can actually add up.
Yeah.
But it's not, they exclude ASX stocks out of it. So if the ETFs are on the ASX, then you're fine.
That makes sense.
So, I mean, that might be another platform which is half the price of this one.
Yep.
What else you could do? I mean, if you're just investing in, there's another way to do this would be to, you actually could open an account with Charles Schwab and then invest in an Australian ETF via them because most of the Vanguard's ETFs are actually available globally, right?
So you buy an Australian, an ASX 200 ETF on the New York Stock Exchange, for example.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually where it's probably primarily listed. And it's secondarily listed here already, it's duplicated somehow. Sure. So, I mean, that's another way you could get $0 if you want to. But then, of course, you're taking the overhead off the exchange rate, right?
The only thing I'd be careful of there is I'm not sure whether franking credits would go straight through a US account. They may not treat them the same.
Yeah, you would not get the franking credits.
Just be a little bit careful there, mate.
Yeah, you would not get the franking credit. So that is the downside there. Again, depends on the mix, but those are the things I can think of on the top of my head.
No, mate, they're great answers. David, a couple of thoughts from me, mate. I love the fact you're using ETFs to invest. I think that's great. I would question, and again, this is not specific investment advice to you personally, I would question whether anyone needs 8 individual ETFs to get broad market diversification. I applaud the fact you want to try and do it. You've got a range of them there. I would, for most people, suggest that you can get almost all of the same type of kind of net outcome with about 3 or 4 ETFs. So you may want to consider just rationalizing that a little bit as one thing you can do. The other thought is, I love the fact you're dollar cost averaging monthly. That is a spectacularly great idea. But I would maybe think about just dialing that back a touch. I don't think you need to invest in everything every month. When we talk about dollar cost averaging, we're talking about adding money to the market every month or every fortnight or every couple of months when you can. And we absolutely think you should keep doing that. But neither Doc nor I nor almost anybody would invest arbitrarily in every stock they owned every month. And so while it's a great kind of concept to do, given the fees, as you say, are way too high, I think you can afford a dollar cost average into the market with 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 of those ETFs in a given period of time, rather than feeling like you have to add to all of them all at the same time. Again, the reality of dollar cost averaging is you're going to buy at roughly average prices through the period. And you buy one this month, another one next month, rather than both this month and both next month. Over time, that also will average itself reasonably out. So I wouldn't feel obliged to add to every ETF every month. I would imagine if you could give yourself maybe something like cut back from 8 to 4 or 5 ETFs, maybe if you feel good about it, and you add to 1 or 2 a month, that's going to probably drop your fees by about 3/4 just by doing that alone, even without changing brokers or doing something differently. So try that. The last thing I would say is if you do want to direct invest, and we probably would suggest you're best off not doing an ASX-listed ETF because it gives you much more liquidity and access, but you can normally add, once you've started a position in an off-market ETF or off-market fund, it's not an ETF by definition, you can add to that, I think, reasonably inexpensively and at reasonably low amounts of incremental investing. So the upfront amount, you might just put a decent amount of money up front. You normally add to that reasonably cheaply. So that might be another option for you.
Yeah, looking at this list, there's a decent amount of overlap in terms of what they hold, right? So Vanguard International, for example, would have some overlap with
Magellan Global Equities.
iShares, S&P, and so on and so forth. Right. So that might be the point you made about maybe reducing the total makes sense. So something to think about.
If people were asking me about the broadest possible diversification, frankly, you could probably get almost all of that outcome. I mean, there's different weightings if you own different ETFs, of course, but you can simply own the AES, which is the Vanguard Australian ETF, and then VGS, which is the Vanguard Developed World ex Australia. That's pretty much the entire developed world there, right? both those together, you get effectively the Western world, which is most of what you're already investing in with other ETFs as well. Some have different ways, different products. And again, if you're happy with that, by all means, go for it. We're not trying to talk you out of it. But I'm not sure you need, for diversification purposes or even for investing purposes, 8 different ETFs. I reckon you can get away with probably half that number and then trade only one or two of them a month rather than all of them. You'll find your brokerage fees drop by about 75%. And I dare say over the fullness of time, the return you get from that portfolio will be largely indistinguishable from what you would have delivered if you'd invested all 8 every single month. Fair to say, Doc?
Yes.
Mate, that's it. We can now have the rest of our Sunday back.
Awesome.
Thank goodness.
Thank goodness.
It's also Friday afternoon here, but yeah. You know, we're pretending it's Sunday because hopefully it's, well, of course, if this doesn't hit the podcast airwaves till Monday, we're going to look silly anyway. So, well, look, I'm taking a decent degree of faith in our wonderful team here at Triple M who do all our production for us. They are wonderful people and we're very, very happy and lucky to have them. So I hope you've enjoyed our foolish mailbag bonus episode. We went to this super regularly, I don't expect. We just had so many great questions and frankly, I didn't want to leave any on the table. I wanted to make sure our wonderful loyal listeners had a chance to hear their questions answered. And hopefully for you, if you didn't send a question through, well, firstly, maybe you will. Secondly, I'm sure you benefit a lot too from hearing about the questions that other people have. So that's it. Don't forget, you can and you should subscribe. Hopefully you already are if you're hearing this on a Sunday. But if you're not, please do subscribe. Hit the subscribe button on your podcast app. If you're listening to this on the web, jump onto iTunes. Jump onto your favorite Android podcast app. If you don't have one, iTunes comes native, which is awesome. So that's the podcast app on the iPhone is wonderful. There's plenty of Android ones. There's a native Google podcast. It's not great because you can't download automatically. Google kind of thinks we're all in the US and we get free unlimited data. We don't here, so you're better off downloading on Wi-Fi. Jump onto, I use Pocket Casts. There's a heap out there, so grab one of those. And of course, when you finish listening, give us a rating because we're vain and egocentric people and we like to feel like we're doing a good job. Is that right, Doc?
It sounds absolutely like us.
Make sure you go to get to some extra foolish goodness. Go to fool.com.au/MMM. Triple M. That's it for this week's special bonus mailbag episode of Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.